When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Fails. Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered.
Okay, history friends, welcome to part 2 of the J. David Markham interview. How are things going? Are you enjoying yourself? I, for one, really enjoyed myself doing this, and I think that really comes across in the course of these 3 parts of the interview. So what is on the box here? What's in the box in this case? And why should you be listening? Well, if you're interested in those 8 episodes of Napoleon that we did release in a remastered version, format kind of thing, then you've come to the right place. In this part of the interview, the following questions will be addressed, as well as some notable caveats, which, well, we just can't help ourselves, we sort of have to get into. We ask when J. David Markham first became interested in Napoleon, the misconceptions that are surrounding Napoleon even to this day, and if any in particular really bother J. David Markham. A very fun question to ask, I think, purely to hear his reaction. I also ask him if there's much to be learned about Napoleon today, and if we can in fact learn from him as a person. In other words, is he an inspiration or is he just a military hero? Let's find out. But I also ask if any books on Napoleon come to mind. What works are out there that you should really kind of track down if you want to further your own knowledge? We also ask about Napoleon's best achievement, his worst mistake, and why there is still a tendency to view Napoleon as something of a villain. So if all this sounds interesting to you guys, welcome to the second part of the interview. And remember to make sure to let me know what you thought through the usual channels, as well as track J. David Markham down. Maybe buy one of his books, or 2 of his books, or 10 of his books, since he is an accomplished author and academic after all, and let him know that you really, really appreciated his guesting on this podcast. I, for one, really did, and I'm very excited to unleash the second part of the interview to you. So enjoy, guys, and happy birthday to When Diplomacy Fails. I suppose to start off this the second part, really, David, I mean, we're going to get into Napoleon more in this section of the interview, or conversation, or collaboration, as the kids these days call them. So I think we should just start with probably the most obvious question, and the one that really struck me when I heard someone, yourself, that is, talking with as much passion about Napoleon as you did. I mean, you mentioned earlier on that you first heard about Napoleon and France, etc., from your father coming back. But how much more to the story is that? Where did the interest in the person of Napoleon come from?
Well, your listeners are going to be just depressed right now, because after leading in with, we're going to stop talking about Markham and we're going to start talking about Napoleon, now we're going to go back to talking about Markham again. So we'll see if they, you know, on Twitter, you I guess it's Twitter, you can listen to something live and you can see the hearts and angers and the various emoticon things floating along. If we could do that, we might see an awful lot of frowns going by. But anyway, as I said, when I was a kid, my dad told me about Napoleon, and it stuck. Of course, my interest went up and down over the years. But in 1983 or 84, after I just got married for the second time and had moved to Phoenix to work for a public labor union, we went to Paris, and I discovered you could collect Napoleonic artifacts such as snuff boxes. I had always been a collector. I collected stamps and I collected American political campaign items. I had over 120 of those.
Wow.
I had over 120 just of JFK, quite a few others, most of which are gone now. So to make room for Napoleon, so that really got me hooked on Napoleonic collecting. And if I say with less modesty than I could, I suppose I now have what's probably a world-class collection: snuff boxes, miniature paintings, bronzes, engravings, some other paintings, Empire furniture, candlesticks, clocks.
Wow.
God knows what. And I have a Napoleonic library of well over 1,000 books. And that's after giving 500 books to Florida State University when I moved to Toronto.
Wow.
To get married the third time. So, and then in 1989, actually 88, when I was living in Phoenix, a group there started up celebrating the bicentennial of the French Revolution. And I had already been involved with the French community, with the Alliance Française and so on. So I got involved in that. Then I took the class I mentioned, got the paper published in a magazine, Military History Illustrated, it was known then, and that led to a book, and I've never looked back. I have to say, you have to pinch yourself, or as Napoleon famously said, what a novel my life has been. And that's not even getting into my personal life, which I could really shock you on probably. I have been given numerous awards over the years, and I'm very proud of all of them, but I'll pat myself on the back a little bit here, if you don't mind. I'm especially proud.
Sure.
That France made me a Knight of the Order of the French Academic Palms.
Wow.
Chevalier de l'Ordre de Palme Académique. That's their highest civilian-only award, and it's second overall only to the Legion of Honor.
Oh, wow.
Actually, I've received two French awards, each presented by a French ambassador at one of my congresses, a congress in Montreal and a congress in Havana. So I've had two different French ambassadors present me two different French awards. And I've got to say, if you'd have asked me 25 years ago when I maybe first started on this, let's say go back to 1988 or so, when I first got involved in this, in a serious manner, or even back to 83 when I started collecting a little bit. If you'd have asked me, if you'd have told me that this is where it was all going to go, I'd have laughed you out of the room. I never ever would have imagined, doing what I've done, becoming, one of the people in my field know about. And that's, it's humbling to be in that circle. It's very gratifying, but it's also, it's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. I never realized exactly how qualified you were, Janie Mack. That's brilliant. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Well, in that case, you're even more better qualified than I'd initially thought to rant about Napoleon. So that's good.
Well, the word rant does seem appropriate, I suppose. Yes.
Well, I suppose we could just get right into the rants then. The thing that really stuck with me, I think, above all, was how determined you were in the Napoleon 101 podcast to kind of burst through all these misconceptions that are held about Napoleon, because there is a lot of misconceptions. So I guess my question is kind of, do any misconceptions in particular really bother you?
Well, the worst misconception, in my opinion, and the one that I hate the most, is that he was a ruthless warmonger, crazed, on accumulating power and conquering all of Europe. It's much more complex than that. If you look at the facts, there were a series of coalitions formed by other countries in Europe against French Revolutionary France, because they couldn't stand the French Revolution. Because if the people of France could overthrow the king, and my goodness, then kill the king, what would prevent the people of Austria, of Spain, of Prussia, etc., even of England, from doing the same kind of thing. So they were determined to reinstate the Bourbons, and they continued that determination even after Napoleon took power. Indeed, Louis XVIII was hoping when Napoleon took power that he would then turn France back over to him. And he wrote Napoleon a letter to that effect. And Napoleon wrote back, my cousin, you would have to go over the dead bodies of 100,000 French soldiers to get that, to happen.
Did he say and, no, though?
Yes, he said no. And he said no. This idea that Napoleon was determined to conquer, Napoleon was almost really essentially always the one who was being threatened. He was the one whose country was under pressure from various coalitions. So, I think people, if they look at it from that standpoint, will see the so-called Napoleonic Wars, a term that I really do not like. Mm-hmm. They will see the wars of the coalitions in a rather different light. Mm. And of course, there's small ones. I mean, he was not, in fact, short.
Yeah.
He was 5'6", roughly, which is approximately the average height of a Frenchman back in those days. Mm. British caricaturists love to make little Boney short and skinny, to put him down. He also didn't go around with his hand in his vest. That was a common pose for painters. And usually the other hand was behind the back because painters don't like painting fingers. And I've seen a portrait of George Washington with the same pose, and that was before Napoleon. So you see paintings and statues of him, on campaign with his hand. That's not a serious image breach. I mean, who cares? But
sure.
But it's not really the way it was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you'll be happy to know that I've called my 8-part series "The Wars Against the French" rather than "The Napoleonic Wars."
Well, that's much more accurate, and I do in fact appreciate that.
Yes, indeed. Well, it was actually very refreshing within the Napoleon 101 series to actually hear a different perspective, like freely available, because you have what's kind of like the mainstream version of history. And I mean, there's versions of, like, it looks different in every kind of era of history. Like, for example, Germany started the First World War and that's that. And like, that's the mainstream version of history. If you ask people in the street kind of who started the First World War or why the First World War happened, most people would say Germany. But obviously there's more to it than that. So,
oh, far more.
Yes, indeed. So like with the person of Napoleon, say, I've always found him a like profoundly interesting character. And I think as people always look at his battles, they always look at his military genius and the like. And I think by doing so, they kind of miss the person of Napoleon himself. And I guess what I'm trying to get around here eventually is, do you think there's something we can learn from Napoleon?
Yeah. First of all, I agree. If you focus only on the military aspect of Napoleon, then you are missing a lot. Now, mind you, there are people who do specialize on the military aspects of Napoleon, and that needs to be studied. Mm. They teach his strategies and tactics at West Point. Mm. They teach it at Sandhurst, which is the British equivalent. They teach him around the world. They teach him in business and leadership classes, his management style, if you will, how he worked with people, how he organized people. But you go beyond that. He's a classic rags to riches story.
Mm.
The relationship with his family in and of itself, is worthy of study, and in fact has been studied. His work in improving France's economy, education, environment, infrastructure, you name it. They're all very important, and we can learn from them, and they set the stage for the future. And his religious tolerance, his insistence and belief on religious tolerance sets the example, you know, freeing the Jews in Italy and Malta, and of course in France, you know, his whole perspective on you know, equality of opportunity in every soldier's knapsack is a marshal's baton, he very famously said. And what that means is that if you have the ability to rise, you should be given, and under his world, you will be given that opportunity to rise as high as your abilities will take you. Liberty, equality, fraternity was the slogan of the French Revolution. Well, he believed most especially in equality, and he followed through on that.
Sure, absolutely. And I think equality, I mean, this might come up later on, but the thing that always stuck with me from Napoleon is, I suppose, standing up for the little guy in a way, and by that I mean the Duchy of Warsaw and the efforts he made for the Poles there. And now, like, people could say, oh, he did that for strategic reasons to upset the Russians and the Prussians and the Austrians, but I think the actual Polish affinity for Napoleon to this day is still quite something. And I think what he did for Polish independence and Polish nationalism, even for that brief, unfortunately brief flutter during that period of time, I think really was, it speaks a lot to the values of the French Revolution, really.
Well, I could not agree more. And sure, you know, the Duchy of Warsaw had its strategic implications and also its drawbacks, because it did piss off, you know, some of these other folks around there. And it was part of the reason for the 1812 campaign. But yeah, the Poles loved him. The Poles believed in him. There's a famous, you know, story with Marie Waleska, of course, who, you know, the Polish aristocracy basically encouraged to be Napoleon's mistress because they thought that might help, you know, secure his favor. And he always promised a little bit more for Poland than he delivered, but he delivered more than anyone else ever had with the duchy. They believed, and they believe to this day, that, for example, had he been successful in 1812, that then they would have been established as a larger, fully independent country. Who knows if that would have actually happened, but of course the results of 1812 made it essentially impossible for him to do more.
Yes, yeah, they did. And I think, unfortunately as well, almost as a side effect of that, because of the way the Poles were so tied up in it then, it was almost as though, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it was almost as though then the Poles were the enemy that could be stamped out, whereas in years past, Poland had kind of been gradually stamped out. Its independence had been removed, and then it was finally partitioned into oblivion in 1795. But right. I guess like, it's sad in a way that the Poles almost became a villain of the story because of their attachment to Napoleon. I mean, obviously that's not factually correct, they shouldn't have been, but in the world where any ally of Napoleon, and we'll come to the issue of allies of Napoleon later on, but in the world where the ally of Napoleon is now someone we can step down on, it was very convenient for the British, and indeed the, well, I suppose the French as well, in a way, afterwards, when they were trying to in a way expunge Napoleon from the country. But the idea that the Poles could be kind of removed and we didn't have to worry about Polish independence and it could be conveniently kind of stamped out, I think it's just awful.
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, it's poor Poland. You know, they, throughout so much of history, they've been caught between big powers. You know, that's the problem. You got the Russians, the Austrians, the French, the Prussians, you know, and here's Poland, sometimes big, sometimes small. And you know, they get sliced and diced routinely. You know, hopefully now for the foreseeable future, you know, while I may not like some of the current politics of Poland, I've been to Poland twice. I love the Poles and had a conference there in Swoops. You know, I absolutely hope that they continue to have great success in the European Union and that maybe the days of them being stomped over or sliced and diced are done. But, you know, time will tell. Yeah. Time will tell. I mean, you know, who would have dreamt that Brexit would have happened? Mm. Who would have dreamt that Trump would have happened? I mean, sometimes you think the world is going along at a very reasonable pace and progressing, you know, in a positive manner. And then suddenly, you know, monkey wrenches get thrown into the gears, and will it just slow the engine down, or will it cause it to break? You know, time will tell.
Yes, indeed. Time will tell. Well, I mean, the reason why I suppose my brain kind of switches to Poland as well is because, as per, I don't know if you know about Patreon or anything else like that, but it's essentially a way where people who create things can earn a small amount of money or a large amount of money in some cases from people that enjoy their products. So, for example, painters or comic book writers or people who wouldn't normally be employed, but podcasters have gotten into it as well. And when you reach certain goals, when you reach certain targets, you basically, as a podcaster or a creator in any kind of sense, you say, okay, when I reach a certain amount of money every month, I'm going to do this. And one of my goals for reaching $500 a month was to essentially release a mini series on Polish history in the 18th century, which is in a way the most depressing period of Polish history, but in a way it's also quite inspiring. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Well, good for you. Good for you. I thought you were going to say when you reach that plateau, you would get a higher grade craft beer.
Well, that too. I think I'll certainly be drinking to the goal when I eventually make it. But yeah, it's very exciting to think of periods of history like that that I'm really looking forward to cover.
Excellent.
Well, I think I would really like to ask as well, and I suppose, I mean, there's a danger that this could become all about J. David Markham. But in a way, that's okay. But at the same time, I mean, we've gone through your impressive works already. So I guess when I ask you the question, if any kind of good books on Napoleon come to mind, perhaps I say maybe name yours and then name ones other than your own as well. How about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, any book by that J. David Markham fellow, of course, is to be highly recommended. There's a flaw in Napoleon for Dummies. Overall, I think it's a very, very good book, and one that if you're only going to read one book on Napoleon, you're only going to read one book, and you don't want to read an 800-page book, I tell you, yeah, read Napoleon for Dummies. If you want to read one book to see if you will become interested in reading more, I would say the same thing. The other books, and I've got Simply Napoleon coming out, which would be a sort of a similar kind of thing, not in the dummy style, but a basic biography that I'm writing with a friend. Otherwise, for a general biography, Andrew Roberts has a book out relatively recently, which is quite good. And I recommend it. Beyond that, I'll tell you honestly, it depends on your interest and I suppose on your language. So I'm dealing really only with the English language. If you read French well, then you get into some of the French historians like Thierry Lenz, who's written some outstanding books on Napoleon in French. He works with the Fondation Napoléonienne. In English, you know, if your interest is in the Peninsular campaign or the Waterloo campaign, there's lots of very good British authors out there, some of which I know well. If you are interested in some of the military campaigns, there are books on specific campaigns. There are books on specific battles. There's books on the relationship. For example, Mike Leggeri has one out on Blücher. It's a great big thick book, extremely well researched. So if you want to learn about Blücher, you know, that's the one to go to. A little side story about that, by the way. My wife Edna is about 3/4 Prussian. So I always joke that I had a DNA testing done to make sure she was not related to Blücher. although in all honesty, it would be kind of cool if she were related to Blücher. And yeah, she orders me around like Blücher. I don't know. It's hard to figure. The irony is I told that story to a very interesting gentleman that I met at the conference last year in Dublin. And he got a good laugh out of it. And that interesting gentleman is the current Prince Blücher, the direct descendant of Marshal Blücher.
Wow.
A really, really a fascinating character. Wonderful. We're having a conference in Germany, but he lives in Switzerland, but he's not going to be able to make it, unfortunately. But just a delightful fellow. He's kind of into Zen Buddhism and stuff like that, apparently. Really friendly guy. And he thought it was pretty cool that I had essentially a Prussian wife that I was worried about being related to his great ancestor. I've had good luck that way. I've met Prince Napoleon and Princess Napoleon. These are all descendants of the Bonaparte family. Napoleon never had a quote-unquote legitimate child that procreated. He only had the one son, the King of Rome, who died at age 21. But he did have a son with his mistress, Marie Walewska, his Polish mistress.
That's right.
I've been to the ruins of the place, you know, where they were shacking up and so forth. It's quite interesting. And I had a chance a number of years ago to meet the direct descendant of Marie Walewska, Prince Walewska, Count Walewska, Walewski, sorry, it's E for men. And we were in Poland together, and we went to where his mother or grandmother, whatever she, great-grandmother, was buried with me, his mother, obviously. He and I became good friends, and he was saying I was his new best friend, etc. 2 weeks after I left him, he died. Which was just a damn shame, because he was a cool guy, and how cool would it be to have as one of your good friends a direct descendant of Napoleon Bonaparte?
We could have got him on the podcast.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, his English was flawless. You know, he was a French businessman and really, really nice guy.
Oh.
He had a brother, but I never knew his brother.
Oh, well, I must track him down. That'd be interesting, yeah. All right, yeah. We've been kind of talking around Napoleon as this kind of... I mean, would it be correct, do you think, to call him a visionary? I think it would.
Oh, of course he was. And, yeah. And by the way, if we don't get to enough Napoleon, you can always have me back on sometime.
I'd love to, yes, very much so. Look, really, for me, I would just like to know, if you had to summarize all of the good stuff he did, I'd say, what would you think would be his best achievement?
Well, that's a tough one, because he did so many things. I mean, he established the Bank of France, which is, of course, still around today. He overhauled the educational system, and much of that is still around today. Mm. He centralized it, made it much better. He did a number of things, but I guess if I had to pick one, I would probably pick the Code Civil, the civil code of France, which is still the basis of French civil law. It brought together and unified French civil law from what had been an incredible hodgepodge of laws and royal declarations and local, you know, proclamations and this, that, and the other thing, you know, incorporated into that much of his belief in the equality of opportunity. And it's still the basis of French civil law and other places in Europe. And also the American state of Louisiana still uses the civil code.
Wow.
And a derivative thereof. And I'm sure it's not exactly the original, but it's based on Napoleon's civil code. And as an American, admittedly living in Canada now, but as an American, I might say that the Louisiana Purchase was another of his best accomplishments.
And that's right.
It made him some money, and it eased the way for our growth and to greatness and our Western expansion, you know. Now, one can argue, probably successfully, that eventually that territory would almost all have become part of America anyway. But this made it so much easier. Take Lewis and Clark, for example. If we did not own the Louisiana territories when Lewis and Clark did their thing, they would have been trespassing on French property for a great deal of their time. And as it was, they were able to legitimately be in the United States of America for an awful lot of their trek westward.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, I suppose I don't want to bring it on a downer now, but I kind of like then on the other side of things to ask what you think his worst mistake was.
Well, it's interesting because if you asked 100 people that, especially on the street, but I would say even, you know, general historians,
yeah,
they'd probably say Russia, 1812.
Mm.
They'd say, oh my goodness, if he hadn't invaded Russia, hadn't they lost all those people on the retreat, although he actually lost more people going into the heat, lost more horses going into the heat, you know, think of how much more success he would have had. And certainly, if he had it to do over again, maybe he wouldn't, but I have always argued that he didn't have any real choice, and besides, the Tsar Alexander of Russia was going to invade him if he didn't go and invade Russia, and he
yeah.
wouldn't. He wanted to take the campaign and fight on their territory and not on Polish and French territory. So, since I've told you what I don't think it is, I would say the Peninsular Campaign.
Yeah.
In my view, that was completely unnecessary. It was all basically about enforcing the continental system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the British were coming in and he needed to boot the British out in his mind. I would have just fortified the Pyrenees as best I could. You know, it's not that easy to get through the Pyrenees. There aren't that many passes. You can fortify the passes. You can, you know, cut off the smuggling trade as best you can.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to cut off all the smuggling trade. My goodness, Josephine was smuggling stuff from Great Britain. you know, I mean, but you could cut it down. You know, the continental system actually was having an impact on Great Britain, a negative impact. It was also hurting France. You know, it was like any kind of a trade war, you might say. It doesn't do anyone any good. If he had not have done that, you wouldn't have had the uprisings. You could still have Joseph on the throne, who knows, but maybe not, you know, maybe none of that mattered. The British would not have been invading France from the south.
Sure.
And if they did, and you had fortified the Pyrenees passes and so forth and not lost so many troops in Spain and Portugal, you know, France would have been a lot more secure. That also would have allowed Napoleon to be much stronger and have his best marshals and troops available, you know, on the Eastern Front when yet another coalition, you know, comes in.
Yeah.
In 1808-9. So I think if you had one thing that I could tell him, you know, in terms of campaigns to do over again, as in don't do it again, I would say it was the Peninsular Campaign. Now, I have a lot of good friends who are British historians, and I respect them all greatly. And I'm afraid they will not be happy with me because a lot of them have made their livelihood writing about the Peninsular Campaign.
Yeah, that's
so
true. Yeah.
If you're a British historian, you're very, very happy that there was a Peninsular Campaign. Mm. And of course, if you're Wellington, you're very, very happy there was a Peninsular Campaign because, of course, that's where he really made his name as well, along with India. And I'm saying this in jest, you know, to tease my British friends, but and carry a step further, without that campaign, Napoleon might never have lost in 1814, and there would not have been a Waterloo, and now these British historians would be out of a job completely.
Yes, indeed, and there might have been more heirs of Napoleon to actually meet in the end.
There you go. Oh, they would have found something to write about. Historians can always find something to write about.
that's true.
And again, they're a really good group of guys. I really enjoy them, and I've started to get some of them coming. I think a lot of them wondered whether or not, you know, they'd be all that welcome at a conference dedicated to Napoleonic study by people who honestly tend to be relatively pro-Napoleon. And I think the first one they really came to out, well, they were some of them in Brussels and in Dublin, and they found that, yeah, we like hearing their point of view and we enjoy their company. So I hope they'll keep coming to our conferences because it really does add needed perspective.
Of course.
When you're listening to papers for several days in a week, you know, you want to hear different points of view.
Sure.
It's not a Napoleon love fest. I mean, if somebody gets up and starts saying Napoleon and Hitler were identical, I'll not be happy. But other than something super extreme like that, which is ridiculous on its face, you know, if they want to say, talk about, you know, where they thought Napoleon went wrong and so forth, that's fine. That's a perspective that we all need to hear.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, you were saying there, looking at it from the other side, and just to drop this surprise on you, I mean, from the other side of things as well, do you think the Allies made some great howlers? I think the one that really stuck with me as a giant mistake was Prussia's random declaration of war when there was French troops, I think, was it 1806 or 1807, and Prussia was basically all alone. And
well, exactly, he didn't get in when he should have, and he got in when he shouldn't have.
Yes,
and certainly, I would say that was a big mistake. I think that Tsar Alexander made a big mistake in not going along with the continental system, at least a little bit better than he did. He was under pressure from family. He was under pressure from his nobility, business people, and so on. But I think he should have really tried to find a way to keep the spirit of Tilsit alive.
Mm.
The family of the Tsar may have made a big mistake when they declined Napoleon's offer to marry his sister. That would have maybe given them a familial bond that would have, you know, made things a lot better. Didn't work out real well with Austria, although it did for a while. I mean, Austria was a somewhat of an ally, although they were conspicuously non-aggressive in certain situations where they could have been. But it certainly had some advantage with Austria. And I think that the Russians should have jumped at the, because this was when Napoleon was at his peak. You know, they should have, this was 1810. You know, they should have jumped at the opportunity to have that tie to Napoleon. And between they were the two biggest powers in Europe, and everybody else would have been sandwiched between them, just like after Tilsit, everybody else was sandwiched between them.
Yeah,
you know, if they could have kept you know that whole thing going, history might be really quite different as well.
So
you know, those the Prussians and the Russians, I would say, probably made the single biggest mistakes.
Yeah.
I also think that the peasants of Spain, in refusing to support you know, Prince Joseph, also made a mistake. But they were very conservative. This wasn't so much anti-French as it was anti-French religious tolerance. And Napoleon had ended the Inquisition, and these were very conservative Catholics.
Yeah.
But ironically, they were writing in favor of a Protestant army that was coming under their soil. So.
Yeah.
Go. At least the French were Catholic, so go.
Yeah, I know. Well, we mentioned there about maybe Napoleon was just too early. Like, maybe he just came too early for Spanish sensibilities. I mean, we can talk about that in a little bit. But I think for me, I'd like to just know, if in your opinion, why do you think there's still a kind of a tendency to view Napoleon as something of a villain? Do you think maybe it's just because we like to have a villain in a story, and he's kind of convenient because he tended to win an awful lot? Or do you think it's just that case where, like, the victors write history kind of thing?
Well, it's you know, check all of the above to a large extent. I think, having said all these nice things about my modern British historians, I will go back further in history and say that until relatively recently, most English-speaking people got their image of Napoleon from 19th century and 20th century British writers who, as they do today, tend to have a decidedly less positive view of Napoleon. And for a long, long time, especially before American historians got involved, most English-language books that weren't translations of French works that were actually originally done in English, mm-hmm. tended not to be necessarily favorable toward the emperor. That's changed somewhat now. There are people who British writers who are, to use Fox News' ridiculous slogan, fair and balanced. You know, unlike Fox, they actually do try to be fair and balanced, and I applaud them for it. There's still some. I've got a book that I'm going to be reviewing by Charles Esdale, who's an outstanding writer, a British historian, one of the very best, but let's just say it's not real favorable toward Napoleon. So there's still some of that, but that's okay because there's books out there that are very favorable toward Napoleon as well. A lot of them tend to be written by either French or especially American writers. Americans tend to see Napoleon in a far more positive light.
That's true. Yeah.
But as you suggest, he's also seen rightfully as a very successful military leader who conquered a lot of territory, installed his family on various thrones, and so on. And in our modern world, especially in the United States and Canada and so on, we tend to kind of look down on that. We don't think, you know, conquering a continent is a good thing. And maybe in part that's because the Germans and Austrians did it twice in the 20th century and didn't work out so well. And so we just sort of lump all this together. Conquers Europe, bad. You know, there's a lot of things that blend into that. He may have been a little early for his time.
Yeah.
We'll talk about, you know, something along that line a little bit later, but, you know, it's really hard to say. But I think the two things that I say, the earlier British historians and some contemporary, and just the fact that we're skeptical of major military force and taking over, you know, the better part of a continent.
Yeah.
We don't feel that way about the Roman Empire. We celebrate the Roman Empire. At least a lot of folks do. We say, the glory that was Rome. Now you dig into that, and it wasn't always so glorious either. There were down, you know, real shortcomings to that. But the image of Rome is in the Western world is very popular, but the image of the 19th and 20th century wars and empires are decidedly less popular.
Very, very true. Yeah. I'm like, well, let's get into that. You mentioned there, do you think that in his victories with like pushing forward his ideas with the Code Napoleon and everything else, do you think he pushed Europe too far with his victories and with his ideas and everything else? Or do you think that at that stage, no matter who would come along, do you think Europe just wasn't ready for someone like Napoleon?
Well, I don't think people were really ready for someone like Napoleon, although it's hard to say when would they be ready and what other kind of personality could have accomplished the things that he did, because he did a lot of things. But I'll give you a good example of where Europe wasn't ready and wouldn't be ready for a very long time, and that's religious tolerance. Europe has a long history of not having religious tolerance. Think of the Huguenot Wars and so forth and so on, the Hundred Years. The religious wars, you know, all the time, you know, the conflict, you know, between Islam and Christianity, the time of Charlemagne and other times. You know, you have this long history, and of course, anti-Semitism, you know, having Jews live in Jewish ghettos. They didn't always have to wear the Star of David. In some cases, like Italy, they did, but they were, you know, frozen out of certain professions and so on. And Napoleon, again, with his belief in equality, said no. You know, he went to Italy and said, take off those Stars of David. No longer do you have to live in ghettos. You can have any profession you want to. Oh, by the way, feel free to build a synagogue now. And he did the same. He did the same kind of thing in France and elsewhere. In Malta, he was there in 1798. Now, mind you, he's only a general. People, a lot of times people forget, this is not Napoleon trying to conquer Egypt. This is Napoleon the general being sent by people who frankly sort of hope he is killed while he's there. You know, think Talleyrand. He's 1 week in Malta. He takes over the island. He boots the Knights Templar out, gives them all pensions, and sends them off to Europe. He organizes a new constitution. He frees the Jews and tells them they should now feel free to build a synagogue, which they hadn't. The new constitution, new educational system, all in 1 week. He does more in a week than most people would have done if they ran the thing for a year.
A week. Wow.
Yeah, it's one lousy week. You know, that shows you the kind of person he was and how progressive he was. And then when he's in Egypt, he's trying to promote religious tolerance as well. So that's way ahead of your time. That's, you know, and even his own family. Remember, he had Cardinal Fesch, you mm-hmm. know, who was decidedly not in favor of freeing the Jews. He had other people, brothers, you know, urging him not to go so fast. And at one point, they actually got him to sort of retreat a little bit, but then he moved back toward where he was. He authorized and supported the Great Sanhedrin of 1808 and so on. So, you know, that's the kind of activity that most people in Europe didn't really see coming.
Alrighty, that was pretty fun, wasn't it? I enjoyed myself immensely there, guys, and I really enjoyed shooting the breeze on Napoleon. But we're not finished yet. There's a third and final part to this interview. So if you like to complete the picture, if you like your stories complete, if you like your interviews all in one bunch, the third part is out right now for your listening pleasure, and it kind of rounds off all the corners. That doesn't really make sense, but it kind of completes everything that's left to say on Napoleon, and it gives us a good conclusion to our remastered effort at Napoleon Bonaparte. The man, the figure, the legend, the inspirational hero in some cases, but also the enigma. So I hope you'll stick around and listen to the third part of this interview. Thanks very much for listening, guys, and I'll see you all very soon.